Okay, good morning. Welcome back, everybody. It's such a pleasure to spend the time learning together today. We're going to be starting on a very fascinating topic, and that is nationalism a Jewish virtue? A very important topic to talk about today. I want to start off by thanking Rosemary and Owen Fish, who are sponsoring today for the Refuah Shlema of Mordechai ben Tzipora Malka and Shendel bas Rachel Bezra Hashem. They should both know a Refuah Shlema. And also in honor of the engagement of their grandson, Zachariah Rosenthal, to Liana Saperstein of Pesach. Mazal tov, Mitzvah Hashem, continued smachos. So let us jump straight in. Nationalism is a very interesting word. It's a very interesting concept, which it's making its way around again a second time round, or well, perhaps second time is not the correct way of saying it, but again, a lot of the commentaries and editorials are talking about in today's context because of what's happening in America. America First is one of these discussions, which is, you know, this sort of focus on America for America has become a question of nationalism again. Rosemary, we just mentioned the Refuah Shlema and the Mazel Tov just a moment ago, so we're continuing to learn for the Refuah Shlema of Mordechai ben Tzipora Malka and Shendel bas Rachel. It's a shem. Should be really a continued Refuah. And the engagement, everything, Mazel Hashem. Thank you for making the share the context to think about this. Let's focus in the following direction. So nationalism raised its head a number of different times and in different spaces and places in the world, and it was a movement which led to a lot of good and a lot of bad. So just to be honest about it, nothing is broad strokes. There's complexity to it. One of the expressions of it in the just perhaps to try to hone in on it, in the Encyclopedia Britannica, in their entry, nationalism has the following observation. This is their perspective. Again, even encyclopedias have interpretations, but this is their interpretation. As political allegiance before the age of nationalism was not determined by nationality, so civilization was not thought of as nationally determined. During the Middle Ages, civilization was looked upon as determined religiously. For all the different nationalities of Christendom, as well as those of Islam, there was but one civilization, Christian or Muslim, and by one language or culture, Latin or Greek or Arabic or Persian later. Late in the Renaissance and the Classicism, it was the ancient Greek and Roman civilizations that became a universal norm, valid for all peoples and all times. Still later, French civilization was accepted throughout Europe as the valid civilization for educated people of all nationalities. It was only until the end of the 18th century that for the first time, civilization was considered to be determined by nationality. It was then that the principle was put forward that people could be educated in their own mother tongue, not in the languages of other civilizations in other times, whether they were classical languages or literary creations of the people who had reached a high degree of civilization. So that's, in a sense, part of what nationalism was bringing to Europe, essentially. And it's worthwhile noting that it had different impacts in different places. So as an example, many attribute the American Revolution, the independence of America from being a British colony as part of the nationalistic movement, the French Revolution as a secular liberalism aspect, or liberal direction of nationalism. This spread to Eastern Europe, to the Germanic countries of their nationalism after France had expressed its dominion and conquest of Europe through Napoleon. These are the rising national values in Europe, and this led ultimately to World War I and ultimately again to World War II, these ideas of nationalism. And later on, we see in the 20th century, because nationalism became actually the flag or the banner for Asia and Africa. So a lot of the colonized countries started expressing a nationalism and therefore independence from their colonizers. And this happened in multiple African countries. India, China, as an example, this is where the spread of nationalism in these different countries. And the question becomes is, as it's spreading through Europe through the 18 and 1900s, so as it's spreading like wildfire as a value, how do Jews react to this? How does Jewry respond to this, in a sense, new? Not in some ways it's new, in some ways it's not new, phenomenon. It's worthwhile noting that to oversimplify things, there's an excellent article just written recently in the Brookings Institute, which has 12 different theses for nationalism. So it's not to make it seem that the Britannica's version of it is simply the only monolithic perspective. There are multiple explanations as to what it means, and to different people it means different things. But as a general, like to be able to get down to nuance now, what does that mean? What did Judaism respond to it? So it's interesting to go back to the thinkers, who Jewish thinkers of the time in the 1800s. What were they thinking? So there's an interesting essay I came across about Rav Hirsch and Rav Breuer. Rabbi Isaac Breuer was whom? Does anybody remember? Close? His grandson. Okay, so Rabbi Isaac Breuer, there was a number of Rabbi Breuers, right? So there's Rabbi Breuers here in Washington Heights who reestablished the Breuers, the German community here in New York City. Rabbi Isaac Breuer was actually the grandson of Rabbi Hirsch, in many ways seen as a continuation of his thought and ideas. However, there are nuances that differ, that differentiate between Rav Hirsch and his grandson. There's an interesting essay written on this. And the topic was Breuer, Hirsch, and Jewish nationalism, change in continuity principle versus super principle. So the observation of the author, Benjamin Brown from the Hebrew U, says the following. I'd like just to quote, starting on the third line in on the second source. This is all just to give the backdrop to try to get to the thought that we're trying to get to. This is all the backdrop of the struggle. So Breuer nailed his colors to the mast of nationalism quite early on in his career when he declared in his article, and I'm going to read the translation, Doctrine, Law, and Nation, considered by many to be one of his most brilliant pieces of writing. Yes, I'm a nationalist Jew, and that's the German translation, Ich bin National Jude. It was in the context of his in social environment a courageous and immensely provocative thing to say. His fellow Jews, secular and religious alike, relishing their status as full citizens of the German state, were wary and famously hostile to anything that might upset the apple cart of integration. They certainly had no intention of spending their time yearning for any practical, meaningful way for the return to the promised land, let alone acting upon this idea. This was equally true of most of Germany's Orthodox community, which, faithful to the teachings of Torah Derech Eretz, that's Rav Hirsch, regarded even as late as the early 1900s the idea of Jewish nationalism as wholly incompatible with the revered teacher's definition of Judaism. As Breuer himself admitted, as a child, the term Palestine was an entirely foreign one. This is not to say that Hirsch, or Rav Hirsch, regarded the Jews as nothing but a religious entity. To his mind, they were no less a people than any other nations. Where the Jews differed was in the fact that their national identity was purely a function of their religion. We talked about this a few weeks ago in Rav Sachs's teachings. Defined exclusively by the Torah, put simply, the Torah and the Torah alone underpinned and determined the Jewish existence as nations. He has a quote of Rav Hirsch. From the hands of God, it was the people of Israel received freedom and nationhood, and as the objective of this is the revelation of his will as a guide for human life, the Torah. In the wilderness, Israel received the Torah, and thus, in the wilderness, without the land, soil of its own, became a nation. So Rav Hirsch is essentially saying is Jewish nationalism, this became the debate, what is Jewish nationalism called in the 1800s? Zionism. Right, so Zionism was a secular reflection of the nationalism happening in Europe, just to make things clear. Yes, there were many other causes. There was persecution, but Zionism essentially was the reflection of Germans saying, we are German, and Frenchmen saying, we're French. So the Jews said, well, we're Zionists. Right, so that's also part of the secular advance. It's not the only theory. You can understand why many religious thinkers were against this movement at the very beginning, if that was the way it developed. So what essentially Rav Hirsch was saying is, our Judaism is, we're a nation because of being a nation of the Torah. And we got the Torah before we got the land. So the land is not necessarily a component of our nationhood. That's what Rav Hirsch was saying. His grandson already, Rav Isaac Breuer, was a very religious individual as well, was essentially saying, I am also a German. The notion of having a loyalty to Palestine, which is what the Zionists are talking about now, is in fact an interruption of that part of my identity. So this is a very big struggle which is being had by diaspora Jewry. And by the way, this was a very sensitive time, right? As Germany was advancing, Germany was very much focused on it being the supreme race, right? And Jews were responding to that at this point in time. You can understand where our Breuer is coming from as well. So this is a very complex topic. To sort of shift into a different direction, to look at other thinkers of the time, just to appreciate some of the ramifications of nationalism in Jewish thought, this is a fascinating observation I came across when reading through the writings of Rabbi Sachs. Rabbi Sachs makes a very beautiful observation, which explains really the 1800s in one broad, we'll call it, trajectory. Here's what his observation is. There in source 3. I'm going to start in the second sentence, second line. The difference was the new nation state, which demanded a monopoly of people, demanded a monopoly of people's loyalty. The nation was no longer where you lived, it was who you were. No longer were you to be a Jew living in France, you had to be first and foremost a Frenchman of the Jewish persuasion. That's how nationalism changed our understanding of ourselves. Anything else constituted a dual loyalty, and that, in the age of nationalism, was the cardinal sin. But what did that mean in practice? No one was entirely sure. It was a question, der Judenfrage, the Jewish question that reverberated throughout the nation states of Europe and the next century and a half and placed Jews in the identity crisis that is not fully resolved to this day. Think about today in America. The result was a fragmentation of the Jewish identity, the likes of which had not been seen since the last days of the Second Temple. Jews twisted and turned, and in their attempt to find some mode of existence that would grant them a safe space in the modern state which, in the name of tolerance, had developed more deadly intolerance than any of its medieval predecessors. Brilliant observation. Brilliant observation. Modifications made by the Reform Jews in Jewish practice and ritual in response to the new scientific way of looking at the world would also, to some extent, soften the distinctive features of Judaism and show, as far as it could be shown, that Jews were like everyone else. So what he's essentially saying is the Reform movement, which was in full steam during the 1800s, and certainly in Germany, where essentially that was where it got its engine was, that was as a response to nationalism, which makes so much sense. Meaning, if I'm going to be questioned as to who I am I a German or am I a Jew? Then the first answer is going to be, I'm German, to show that I'm part of this nation, because that's how my identity is. And oh, well, all these vestigial practices and all this, we'll call it antiquity and ancient practices, well, we'll reform some of those, right? We'll streamline a little bit so we'll be a little less distinctive, right? So our shuls will also have organs, right? We're going to go in that direction to ensure the language of prayer is going to be German, right? We're going to now conform in order to answer this question. That's a very brilliant observation about where the Reform movement was coming from. Bearing that in mind, it's worthwhile looking at those captains of the ship who are steering through this terrible storm, and those who managed to be able to drive Judaism through this very tumultuous stage in history. And there were many. One of them was a man by the name of Rav Meir Leibush. His name was, we know him more famously as, the Malbim. Now, the Malbim we remember as a commentator on Chumash and on Nach. But the Malbim was, in fact, a rav of a community, and he actually started writing a Pirush on Shulchan Aruch, which he stopped in Aruch Chaim in order to shift his gear to move towards a Pirush on Tanakh. And he was one of those flag bearers of trying to hold the mast, trying to hold the rudder in the storm of the Reform movement in the 1800s. And in fact, the Malbim explains why it is that he wrote his Pirush on the Torah. He started writing on which Sefer? What was the first Sefer that the Malbim wrote on? First Pirush was on Sefer Vayikra. And in fact, his commentary was not on the Torah. His commentary was on the Midrash Halacha. Because what was under attack by the Reform was Torah Sheval Peh. Right? We can take this Bible, right, with a little bit of academic criticism, but we can take this Bible, but all that rabbi stuff, you know, hey, Mom Ruve, you know, they said, we said, right? So we'll re-adjudicate this. This is all nonsense, you know, sort of rabbinic interpretation, you know, so we can also interpret, right? We also have the shoulders to do such. So what the Malbim is his principle is if you knew how to read Torah properly, if you really had the sophisticated tools to read properly, the Torah properly, you would automatically arrive at the same conclusions that Chazal arrived at. You just don't have the tools. So he goes and enumerates in his introduction to Vayikra, which he calls Ayeles HaShachar, he explains how to read Torah, and he gives 613 principles of reading Torah, not mitzvahs, principles about how to read text. And in this introduction, this is what he says, what drove him? What motivated him to write his Pirush Anach, which has revolutionized our way of looking at the world, is the following. He says in one of the interleading paragraphs in his introduction to Vayikra, I apologize, I put by Midbar, it's Vayikra. This is Vayibishnas Hataf Reish Dalad. So we talk about the year 1844. Li Yetzira. Kol kachola shamanu tzora kamebechira. I heard this terrible, this call of, a sickly call. Kol Torah Hashem techifa tis yafeach tefaresh kana kapel v'dimasal lecheya ki bogdu ba re'eha. The Torah calling out because those who are dedicated to it rebelled against it. Kinivaru ksas re'e Ashkenaz v'es Hashem no'atzu. The shepherds of Ashkenaz of Germany came together and cursed Hashem. And they gathered together to annul his law. And the shepherds got up to eat their sheep. Right, that's the idea of them betraying their followers. They called themselves rabbis. They called themselves leaders. Now the comparison over here of the battle of the four and the five kings is all biblical terminology, very beautiful. So this is referring to a conference, a reform conference, which was had in 1844 in Brunswick in Germany. And he is, this was a conference, just to give you a sense of what actually happened at this conference. In this, it was essentially the formalization of many of the ideas of Reform Jewry into one. So at this conference was the time when women were voted into count for a minion. This was the conference in which they declared that Kol Nidre was no longer a part of the service. At this point in time, these were like sort of all the, we'll call it actual validations, execution of reform ideas into law. And multiple rabbis from across, introduced these ideas. And essentially, this was one of the pivotal changing points where Reform Judaism didn't just in individual ideas or individual communities adopt these practices, it now became centralized. It became a part of liturgy and service. And he says, "V'yispoitzetzu hakadim arekim," and all these empty vessels, you know, were all just making a lot of noise. "V'yizra'u alapidim v'yislagtu ha'shualim katanim u'viznaseihem udim," and now reference to Sefer Shoftim, where the foxes are running around with torches attached to their tails, burning the fields, right? "V'teitzei esh v'toichal shamir v'shayis." And they burnt down field, destroying everything you could see internally, externally. And they wanted to destroy not just the Ark of the Covenant, not just the tablets, but everything about Jewish law. That's his reference to what's going on in Brunswick. At such a time, it's a time to stand up for the honor of God, says the Malbim. I decided it's time to make a fence around the Torah Shebal Peh and the Torah Shebichsav to protect it from all these empty people. Whether it be the written law, the Torah Shebichsav, which they view as some sort of, you know, nice fairy tale, or like a national fairy tale that we have with us, accompanying us for national heritage around, you know, campsite fires. And they said, it's like, you know, Greek legends. We also have our own legends. That's what they said about the Torah Shebichsav. Even the Torah Shebal Peh, whether it be the oral law, which they said is, you know, a parable, you know, interesting thoughts of these rabbis. And they said it's you know, negotiable. They despise the wise. And they said, oh, they just didn't know how to read properly. But us academics in the 1800s, we now have sophisticated tools about understanding the Torah, so we can tell everybody else what was really going on. So the Malbim says, I'm going to get up and I'm going to defend. I'm going to show you that if you really knew how to read the Bible properly, then you would understand that there is no other way to read it except for the way Chazal read it. So that's what the Malbim is getting up, just to understand the context of his Pirush. Now, we remember the Malbim, and the Malbim has won the war in many ways. We have the Malbim and we respect the Malbim, but you understand that during his lifetime it wasn't so simple. In fact, as a result of this very sharp criticism of the Reform, which no doubt made its circulations on social media very fast, so he was a rav in the community. He lived in Romania, and when he came to his post in the 1860s, he undertook to maintain this, the kashrus of the community, to maintain the Orthodox laws in that community, and he came under great attack from the liberal, more reform and rich Jews of the particular area that he was in, to such a degree that they reported him to the authorities and got him arrested. So just to read this, this is from encyclopedia.com. His son died in 1861, his son died in 1862, and listen to this, towards the end of the Thin Lines. At the same time, his rapidly deteriorating relations with the enlightened members of his community made his position precarious. Because of Malbim's uncompromising stand against reform, disputes broke out between him and the communal leaders of the town, leading to his imprisonment. On Friday, March 18th, 1864, Malbim was arrested and jailed. He was freed only on the intervention of Sir Moses Montefiore, and on condition that he leave Romania and not return. Upon his release, he was placed on a boat sailing down the Danube River. He was put ashore in the Bulgarian border town of Rushuk. M. Rosen has published various documents which disclose the false accusations and calumnies against the Jewish assimilationist enemies wrote against him to the Romanian government. They accused him of disloyalty and of impeding social assimilation between Jews and non-Jews by insisting on adherence to the dietary laws. It was always about kashrus, folks. And said, this rabbi, by his conduct and prohibitions, wishes to impede our progress. As a result of this, the Prime Minister of Romania issued a proclamation against this ignorant and insolent rabbi for his effrontery in publishing libelous letters against those eating meat from any butcher's shop that he preached against against the idea of progress and freedom. So do you understand what was happening here, by the way? He never recovered from this. He appealed to the Ottoman emperor, who declined his appeal. He was therefore permanently removed from Romania. He tried a few posts, and he was a rabbi in a number of posts for a very short period of time. He was invited to Kiev and died on the way. This is the end, if you think about this, because of these folks. How did they frame their attack on his trying to preserve Orthodox versus Reform Jewry? Was, this is anti-nationalistic. That's what they said. Because you are defending these differing principles, which make us eat differently, look differently, act differently, then you're not really a Romanian. You don't really believe in the empire we live in. You don't believe in the nation. You don't believe in change and progress. You live back in the dark ages. You're part of that group. And that's what their attack was. And you know what? They ate it. They believed it. That's what the Malbim's persecution. Shocking. But you understand what the milieu of the struggle that's being had at this time. Brian, I'm sorry, I interrupted.
So basically you're saying that the mainstream accepted theology was the Reform Haskalah theology, and they had enough influence to say that he was breaking laws.
Correct. Well, I mean, well, at least it's unbelievable. And that's what the government believed, because it's speaking the language of the time, which is, what identity? Do you have a dual loyalty? Your religious identity, and if you think about it, Haman did the same job beforehand. Right? That language comes back again. It comes up at various different times. They're different, right? So this is what's happening. And now, in the backdrop of nationalism, that's a crime as well. Joel?
I'm trying to understand the concept of the movement. The rabbis, until that point, were no reform yeshivas,
correct,
so to speak. So they were all coming out of Orthodox yeshivas. So was it the rabbis who were pushing it, or the people were pushing the rabbis to change?
Well, it's more complicated in the scope of our time together today. But the people who initiated the reform movement were very learned Jews. They were struggling with some of these very self-same questions. Let me just go back to Moses Mendelssohn, right? One of the most brilliant individuals, one of the most brilliant individuals who ever lived. He was such a genius, and his writings. He struggled with this very issue, and he ultimately started writing on this particular topic. And all the reforms at the beginning sounded altruistic. So it started with, you know, the question is, where does the bima belong? In the front of the shul? In the middle of the shul, the people, it's better to be among the people. What language should we be praying in? Look, the new generation don't really understand this Hebrew business. So let's move towards German, and people, the youth will be more connected. Those sound like very altruistic movements. People like the Chasam Sofer understood where they was going, right? So they understood the slippery slope, and they said, we're going to put a peg in right here, because even though it looks altruistic, it looks good, we know where it's going, and ultimately it did go in that direction, because now all you need is one more generation reading these writings. And ultimately, it created a whole generation of new rabbis and new community leaders who all sort of drinking this Kool-Aid and said, you know what, we can get much further up the ladder being this way, being more German than Jewish. And Jewish is a wonderful flavor, you know, like everyone's got flavors. But there was multiple moving pieces. But it ended up, this is already now, we were talking about already half a century later than that. So that's when it started to become much more official as well. But by the way, these things happen very fast, which is why being a rabbinic leader of the magnitude of what I could call a Gadol HaDor, it's very hard to sort of to be able to pinpoint exactly these moments and to be able to put your finger in that hole before it turns into a flood. Other people, just as an interest, out of interest, although the Netziv was very careful about his writings on these things, it is worthwhile reading with this backdrop, the Netziv, who's living in the 1800s as well, the Rosh Yeshiva of the Voloshin Yeshiva. It's important to read, you know, I just thinking about this morning. Where would the Torah talk about this notion of the danger of nationalism? One of the places to look for it is to look at the Migdal Bavel, right? So as an example, you just sort of hear the echoes of this in the Netziv's Pirush on the Migdal Bavel. So the people said, Pen na futz al panei kol aretz. He says, maybe we're going to, lest we all spread out. So the Netziv says, he says, Omnam yesh lavin ma choshashuim yotzu kamalu acheres. Why were they concerned? Why were they worried? The other people are going to leave Babylon, right? This is because of the one language that they wanted to speak at the beginning. They said, you know what, if you start speaking different languages, you're going to start thinking differently. He says, so they said, no, we want everybody to stay. We like everybody to be Babylonian. No permanent residence here. Right, and anybody who sort of had different ideas, we'll burn them just to make sure that we're going to sort of maintain ideology. So that the language is a reflection of ideology, and therefore that's why Avraham Avinu was burnt at the stake, right? And that's why he started talking differently. So you sort of in the backdrop of that, the Netziv is not going to try to create any waves. But it's worth thinking about what he's saying in the context of the time he's living in. The Voloshin Yeshiva was shut down by Russian authorities because they targeted it for introducing secular learning to a point that the yeshiva could no longer operate. One of the most illustrious yeshivas in Europe. Complicated times. Rabbi Elchanan Wasserman wrote a sefer called Ikvas de Meshicha. Right. Well, there's one part of the essay. This is a translation. It was originally in Yiddish. He has a translation of what he says in Ikvas de Meshicha. He says, nowadays the Jews have chosen two idols to which they offer up their sacrifices. They are socialism and nationalism. The new gospel of nationalism can be defined very briefly as, let us be like the other nations. Right? Nia kagoyim. All that is required of the Jew is national feeling. He who pays the shekel and sings atikva is thereby exempted from all precepts of the Torah. It is clear that this idea is considered to be fundamentally idol worship from the point of view of the Torah. These two forms of idol worship have poisoned the minds and the hearts of the Hebrew youth. Each one of its tribe of false prophets in the shape of writers and speakers who do their work to perfection. Now, he's obviously talking about how it turns into not just nationalism, but Zionism, which he is correct in identifying as, generally speaking, as a movement, a secular movement, was a reflection of nationalism, not a reflection of Torah Zionism. But there was a camp of Torah Zionism as well, it makes it more complicated than just simply black or white. But nonetheless, all of this was simply an introduction just to get a sense of the struggle that 18th century Jewry is having with these concepts, with what's unfolding in the Europe around them. Now we have the opportunity of meeting a thinker who is a revolutionary, visionary thinker, and his perspective on this. And he's writing at this point in time in the 1890s, so he has there's 30 years still, or 20-something years till the First World War, but it's really, I've seen a century of the development of nationalism, seen the development of Zionism. We're now at those times where the World Zionist Conference is meeting. This is the thought of Rav Kook. Let's start now. Rav Kook, also a graduate of the Voloshin Yeshiva, a visionary at this point in time, a Rav, he was a Rav in a small town in Lithuania, Zymel. And then later on, Boisk, and then 1904 moves over to Israel to be the Rav of Yafo and the Yeshuvim. Here's what he says. A lot of his theology appears in his writings, but we've been learning this on Shabbos, and I just wanted to share this beautiful idea here. This is what he says in the Gemara in Brachos, the very end of Brachos, that relates to name changes. And so we've just come across, we just finished Vayishlach. Vayishlach was Yaakov Yisrael, twice over. And he goes back to the original name change, which occurs. And this is in Source 7, the Gemara in Brachos. The Gemara says, Avram, who Avraham? So Avram is the name, Avram comes to the name Avram originally. B'tchilo na'ase av la'aram, ulebasoif na'ase av l'chol ha'olam kulay. The beginning he was an av to Armenia, to Aram. And later on, he became an av to the entire world. Sarai af he Sarah betchila nase Sarai leumasa levasoif nasa Sarah lekol olam kula. At the beginning, she was individually a princess, a leader, and at the end, she became a princess or a queen to the entire world. That's what the Gemara says as well. By the way, just as a side note, it's worthwhile noting in the phrase Av Hamon Goyim, is there ever a resh? There's no resh in that phrase, right? Which is why it's funny. His name is not Avham, right? His name should be Avram, not Avraham, right? The resh doesn't fit. So Rashi says, is that it's a vestigial resh. It belongs to his original name, which means to say that even when you change and you expand, you can't forget where you came from. Just important rule that Rashi makes the observation, because otherwise the resh is uncalled for. Nonetheless, the Gemara then goes on to say, Tani bar kapara, kol hakoyre la'Avram Avram, oiver ba'aseh. If you call Avraham, Avram now today, then you are transgressing a positive enactment. Shinemar, Vayashimcha Avraham. Your name should be Avraham. Rabbi Lezer Omer, Oiver Beloy Sasi, you even transgress a negative precept, Veloy Kore Oid Shimcha Avraham, so that your name should never be Avraham. And then the Gemara goes on to discuss, well, what about Yaakov and Yisrael, which seems to flip-flop, goes backwards and forwards. That's the next question, the Gemara. So Rav Kook looks at this Gemara, and of course we read this Gemara and we say, oh yeah, of course, you know, Lech Lecha, Bris Mila, fantastic names, everything's wonderful. But, truth be told, Rav Kook sees a much more profound, we'll call it vision of history. And he has his observation in Source 8. This is his commentary on the Gemara and Brachos in Ein Hayah. Here's what he says. He's going to skip the embolded section, which is the beginning. He says, Haregesh, from the third line where it's unembolded, he says, Haregesh Hale'umi, the national feeling, the feeling of being part of a larger nation, who regesh yashar tivi ba'adam, if a person were to let themselves feel it, is a natural experience in the human condition. Karov lamala avas hamishpacha v'ole olea b'moisiriusai. It is even a higher moral imperative than the love of family, loving your team, which is your nation. Okay, by the way, just that's a very profound statement to make, especially in the milieu of what we've just been seeing. Okay? To say that in Europe at this point in time is a big thing. Then he says, Al Kain, Gam Avraham Vesara Biyosam Anshe Yosher, Me'atzmam, Me'etzem Tivam, Hayu Da'agim L'Kiyum Alumi Shalom Osam Vatzlachasam. As moral people, principled people, they were people who therefore cared about their nation, deeply cared about their nation. Any principled person cares about their nation. That's natural because that's an extension of yourself. It's your own identity which is being extended. Aval, but they did not simply remain moral people. They didn't simply self-invent themselves and remain at that moral plateau. Then now there was an intervention. God spoke to them and elevated them even higher. So what's higher than a feeling of nationalism? That's his answer is, Ki loy zeh hu adayin gemar tachlis ha'osher. The completion is not at nationalism. Ki adam ha'shalem ein adai shi'atzamtzeim atzmei bo'osher umasoi. It is not enough to care only about your nation. Ki tzorichu lishtadel la'vi Yeshua klalis. You need to be not national, but universal. Right? It's not enough to be an Avram. It's not enough to care about Armenia and where you come from, even though that is a natural calling. It has to be that you're universal. Okay. More than national belief. Brilliant. Okay, so what he's saying is, the first natural step of any human being is to care about their own. Is to care about not just their family, not just their number one, which seems to be the only value in this in Western society today, but beyond that, to stretch themselves for those around them, those who share the same values, those who share the same political sovereignty, the same territory. Care about them, because that's a natural moral feeling. But to stop there, he says, that's where Avram was as a universalist, as a moral imperative. More than that, you need to have the Nevu'i. The precept of God will now elevate you to be a universalist who cares about more than simply what is just around you. So nationalism is an important value, says the Rav Kook, but it's a first step in the value system. Let's take it further. Now, these words are almost prophetic. Here's what he says. So the next paragraph. He says, so why does Bar Kappa say you cannot call Avraham anymore? So why is that illegitimate? He says, Kitzorich Lashrish in the Kuf Ayin Hay, in paragraph Kuf Ayin Hay, Kitzorich Lashrish, you need to put in the foundation, Shetachlis HaMatara Shel HaLeumiyut Shel Yisrael, Einoch Chazkenu L'Atzmenu V'Kivisha Zamim V'Kirze B'Zeh. Nationalism is not meant to be the extension of us so that we conquer the rest of the world. Right? Dvorim Shekol HaAmim Mishtoikakim Lohem Merov Avas Atzman. Which all the other nations do because of their self-love, meaning, because I love Germany so much, we need to make the rest of Europe German. Because I'm a Frenchman so much, I would like to conquer the rest of Europe and show everybody that they should speak French. That's what nationalism will lead to if you stop there. That is not what we're experiencing. Our nationalism, being proud of our heritage, is supposed to lead to universalism that we care about more than ourselves. Not to conquer them, but to educate the rest of the world with values so they can be themselves as well. So therefore says the Rav Kook, it is illegitimate to call Avraham. Why? Because what you're doing is you're limiting him to that national value. That Avraham was only a stepping stone to become an Avraham. You need to care about your own in order to be able to care about the rest of the world. Call him only a nationalist. Call the Jew only a person who cares about themselves. That is illegitimate. Brilliant. This is the building of who we are. This is the fiber of our being, suggests Rav Kook. One last comment, and we'll just pull it all together now. We're going to skip the one about Sarah, because he differentiates between Sarah and Avram, actions and ideas, though, so to speak, the tradition of women, the tradition of men, and the converging of those in both elements of our nation. That's a general idea he takes over there. But in Kuf Ein Zayin, on the right-hand side, he says the following. Let's actually go back to the Gemara. The Gemara asked the following question at the very end. So let's go back to the Gemara for us for a moment on page 6. The Gemara at the very bottom of the Gemara says the following. It's about 5 lines from the bottom. In the middle of the line, it says, Mesiv Rabbi Yossi. So Rabbi Yossi bar Avin asks the following questions. Vitame Rabbi Yossi bar Zvida. Now that I option of the name. In source 6 on the Gemara and Brachos, back again. Sorry, source 7, page 6. The Gemara says, Ato hua Elokim, asher bacharto ba'avram. We said this this morning in Davening, right? This is in our Davening in Pesuk of Zimra. You are Hashem who chose Avram. So 1 second, so what's the question? What's the question here? Whereas in the prophet himself uses the word Avram, but you just told me in the Gemara you're not allowed to do that. So did he not read this Gemara? Did the prophet not read the Gemara? So the answer is, he says, Hasom, the Gemara answers, Navi huda komesada l'shavche derachmona, maida hava meikara. The prophet is not calling him Avram. The prophet is saying, I'm talking about the trajectory of Jewish history, and I'm praising Hashem that it started off as Avram and moved to Avram. It isn't to identify him and to put on his passport Avram. It's to say that this is the Messiah Shivcha Shal HaKadosh Baruch Hu. There's this trajectory. Says Rav Kook, you see over here an interesting thing. On the one hand, we're not allowed to call him Avram. That's not who we are. But on the other hand, it isn't treif to describe that there was a trajectory of moon from Avram to Avraham. That's what Gemara is essentially saying. So where does nationalism live then? In this Twilight territory, essentially, if you think about it. Let's take a look at his words here. And Kuf Ayin Zayin, the last page. We are skipping the embolded sections. And just to close the thinking of Rav Kook on this, the last one in the line is Kfar, which is unembolded. Kfar bi'arnu, shemidas Yaakov tzricho lo'olam gam mizgadol b'hamal al-erech Yisrael. We're not going to get into Yaakov right now because it's his own essay, not on nationalism, but on how we deal with adversity from the Christian empire. That's a separate topic. Okay, but why you need Yaakov in Yisrael. But now the point of us is the following. Mibnei shemikol makom hergesh ha'le'umi hu lo'olam gam ket mitzad atzmai regesh na'ale mo'omole tzedek v'yosher. Nationalism by itself is in fact a righteous idea. The idea itself is itself a good idea. It is a morally upstanding idea. But if it does not have a higher calling to it, listen to these words, it will break through in the end. It may actually pop the top off and break through beyond its calling. And then what would that lead to? To try to take lands which don't belong to it. B'loy shum tachlis u'matara kedusha, b'loy shum mishpat tzedek. Without any higher, lofty, holy calling, and without any justice to it. This is a prediction of World War One. This is before the Ottoman Empire and the assassination of the Albanian prince and all the other causations. What the Rav Kook is saying is, I'm looking at the Europe today, and I can see this is going to end in a terrible destination. He's right, because that's what happens when nationalism is without a higher calling. Aval, mipnei sheb al kol ponim hu nivchar la'atzmoi al kein lo elam am ein sorich shiyeh ne'ezav kumoi havet midas hatovois. But it is not like a fully good attribute or idea or ideology. Because a really purely good ideology, even the lowest iteration of it, still is safe. So you understand what he's saying over here? On the one hand, nationalism is a very favorable idea, otherwise it wouldn't be talked about. It wouldn't be, so to speak, part of Jewish culture, which he's saying it is. But on the other hand, it is not purely good because the lowest rungs of it are dangerous, right? It lives in this middle zone. Going down to the bottom area here, since it can be utilized in a positive direction. It was totally and fully corrupt. Then we would never allow it into Judaism. It is therefore part of what the Navi actually says. Yes, there was an Avram. There was a stage where we were fully nationalist. There was a stage where Avraham Avinu was a very proud, patriotic, nationalistic, those are two different words, but nationalistic Armenian. Hashem said, because you care so much about beyond yourself, about your nation, I'm going to take that as a platform to make you a universalist who's going to care about the whole world at large. That's who Avraham is going to be. He says, this is a intergenerational teaching. Al yedias erech alumiyos, to understand nationalism, ledas tachlisot, to know its destination, veich lishtamish bo, and how to use it, leman tia lanu lemigdal oz, so that it should be as a tower of strength, v'ateres tiferes, and a crown of glory, k'moy shekosuv, lintoyah shamayim v'liosod oretz, v'lomer tzion amiata, of course pivoting towards Tzion, right, as he is saying. What a phenomenal, revolutionary thing to say. Not an in a retrospective backseat driver and Monday morning quarterback position. In Europe, while this is going on, seeing the bad and the ugly, seeing the positive at the same time. What a phenomenal interpretation of understanding what's going on. This is what it takes. And these are the leaders of the time struggling with these very concepts. Rabbis, I think this is just worthwhile contemplating and appreciating and looking for those today who have this kind of shoulder, these kind of shoulders, this kind of latitude to make these kind of observations. Rabbi Hanan Kashmir, so I got to go to the Zakas, I'll be here on the 20th of the Rabbi Adir.